In a world where the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola is a respected actor with his grip on Oscar gold.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Also in a world where that same actor regularly loses his shit. And owes millions in back taxes and alimony. While buying rare comics and dinosaur skulls. The winds of Nick's career blow hot and cold. As we present Super Serious Film Fest's Season of the Cage.
So Season of the Witch kind of confounded our ability to do an improvement. It's such a lukewarm tapioca project. There it's very little spiced egg. There's nothing super bad about it, and I don't know, just our heart wasn't in it. And what we really wanted to do is just kind of talk Cage. Like, we're wrapping up the film fest. This is the closing address. This is something we've never done before. We would just like kind of like focus in on something. And I kind of had a preconceived idea of what my feelings for Nick Cage were. And then they kind of changed towards the middle and end. And then when we were doing kind of the research for this, or Nick Cage retrospective, I found that my feelings shifting again. So I start off with a favorable. Like, I love Nick Cage, and I'm in for anything that he does. Even when he's in a mediocre film, he's always entertaining. Nick Cage seems like a oblivious, obtuse, pretentious asshole. Nick's probably he's probably an all right guy. He just has got no feedback mechanism to bust him out of the like kind of teenage preciousness you have, where you're 16 and you have a thought that a billion people have thought before, but you think it's original and meaningful to you. Like, no one's around to be like, hey, dumbass. Yeah, he's born from this Hollywood royalty. He's essentially been probably well off and successful his entire life. Why would he ever go about changing some of his core like beliefs or values? Or if he just starts thinking that he's a magical shaman, who's going to tell him he's not? You know, he literally lives in a castle. How did you have a similar kind of a journey?
Yeah, I guess I started this whole thing looking at Nicolas Cage as a bit of a joke. And you know, I love some of his movies. They're some of my favorite films from my late teenage years,
sure,
and early teenage years. But I always, you know, thought, oh man, he puts on these ridiculous performances. I love him for that, but he's a joke to me. And somewhere along the research, like reading interviews with him and like reading stuff about, you know, his nouveau shamanic acting, as he calls it, and his Germanic expressionist style of acting in some places, I wouldn't say I came to a respect of Nicolas Cage, although that might not be a bad word for it. I think Nicolas Cage is a man driven by his own passions, damn what everybody else thinks about him.
Right.
And I have a really hard time faulting him for that.
Yeah. And his passions change a lot. And if I think of the things that I was super into from the time I was 13 to the time I'm now, it seems like I'm 10 different persons. I'm super into comic books and science fiction. And then I was really into motorcycles. And then I was really into fixing cars. And then I was really into RC helicopters. And then I was really into sailboats. And then I was really into archery. And like every single one I was like super passionate about would have a deep, like long conversation. But they were just the things I was into at the moment. And unfortunately, Nick Cage gets interviewed on national outlets. So he just seems like he's this wall of contradictions. But I think the thing that the asshole kind of vibe and the oblivious or like pretentious vibe I got was just him trying to, instead of being like, I guess, that self-aware about it, like, well, these are just the things I'm into and they kind of come. It's like he's always trying to find something. And this, it's this, this shamanistic, nouveau shamanistic routine, I think, is something that really speaks to him. Like, he, I think he feels connected in some kind of magical way to humanity and the planet. And that, 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 and maybe it's from tons of shrooms, because one of the formative experiences he had was doing shrooms with his cat. And like exchanging bodies and my like
some sympathy shrooms, solidarity shrooms that he did with his cat. Yeah.
Yeah. He seems, and then like, I, as a person who has dabbled with some hallucinogens in limited and infrequent ways, if you do that, like, Nick seems like the type of guy that maybe drops acid once or twice a month.
I'm going to say it's not the only time he's done acid is with his cat.
Right. Like, it, it's one of those things where it's like, he could be looking so far outside the box that he's just on a different kind of plane of understanding than I am. And yeah, he's pretentious and he's always looking to ways to kind of myth make about him, his own self. But he doesn't seem like he's malicious. He just seems like he has a mean bone in his body.
That's the thing. He is unapologetically Cage, but he's hurting nobody doing it.
Yeah.
So I say let Cage be Cage, man.
Right. Someone had started some vicious rumors about him, like, you know, engaging in drunk driving and I think this, alleging in some kind of abuse. And he successfully sued them for libel and got an apology out of him. And then I think was pretty conciliatory after the fact. Again, it just he seems like a weirdo, but a harmless one. So I tend to get along with those types.
Sure.
And it's like my nadir of my Nate and my Nick Cage relationship was when I was looking at his commentary for Vampire's Kiss. I'm just like, it'd be like if, you know, we ever get around to doing the retrospective of a Blue Yonder. And instead of being like, Jesus Christ, I had no idea what I was talking about. Oh, my God, I can't believe I said that. If I tried to find some theory of like, oh, what I was going for is to elicit this reaction in the listener. And but maybe Nick did. Like, I was just a goofball on a microphone saying stupid shit. But maybe he actually did think that. And he's actually saying a straightforward account of how he did something crazy like the Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah. No, I mean, he at times describes, you know, what he's going for in movies, and you look at it and you go, okay, no, actually I understand what you're talking about here. When I look at your performance and I look at the things you're saying, they tie together.
Yeah.
It kind of makes sense. Like, if you told me, oh, he's going for a Nosferatu kind of Germanic expressionism in his acting style in Vampire's Kiss, I'd be like, yeah. No, you're exactly right. You nailed it, actually.
How can you prove that wrong? Like, if someone says, I'm going for an old school werewolf approach to podcasting. I'm going for more of a gothic werewolf approach for my podcasting.
I think you're nailing
my skills
it, yeah.
In the mic. Yeah, I mean, shit. There's multiple ways you can interpret that. There's very few attacks you can mount on it other than, well, this is fucking absurd. And that's the thing. Like,
and he doesn't care.
Yeah, he's going to keep on shamaning, man.
Yeah, no, it's kind of amazing. I got to say, I really like Nicolas Cage. And I hope like he continues to just do his thing. It seems like at this point in his career, it shocks me. Every day that I think about Nicolas Cage is a day that I am shocked that he has a career at all. Mm-hmm. And if he weren't a Coppola, I can't imagine that this guy gets out of his first two movies with a career.
I found this quote by Roger Ebert, and I can't remember what review I read it from or if it's just him talking about Nick Cage, but he says, Nick Cage is a good actor in good movies and an almost indispensable actor in bad ones. Because what I've seen in this serious, super serious film fest is when the occasion requires it, he is perfectly capable of giving a very good, nuanced performance.
Yeah.
But when the material is like either he's just cashing a check or it's fundamentally silly or weird or interesting to him, he sets flight. And we talked about how Vampire's Kiss wouldn't probably be worth watching. It would be like a late night Cinemax thing at best. Mm-hmm. But Nick Cage turns it into something that everyone should probably see.
Yeah.
There's two types of people. Like if I say behind this curtain, there is a guy and he's going to mediocre read Shakespeare. You know, and behind this curtain, there's a guy's going to bite the head off a living chicken. There's a lot of people just like, I got to see a guy bite the head off a chicken. Like, you know, animal cruelty, all that aside, like that's just a spectacle. And Nick Cage guarantees a spectacle. And that's why I guess I really didn't like Season of the Witch, because I felt like he was going kind of serious restrained cage, and that movie was begging for him to let fly.
Yeah, it's also interesting to me that I don't think Nicolas Cage's performances work at the time they're made, but they only work in retrospect. Like, you have to kind of have the reputation that Nicolas Cage has for someone to say, hey, you should go see this movie because this guy acts like a lunatic in it. When you tell me Nicolas Cage is acting like a lunatic in an old movie that he made, I'm like, yes, I'm in. If you tell me, oh, this actor, you know, was in this movie, some random actor in a movie in 1982 that he acts like a lunatic, I'm like, eh, pass.
Right.
Don't care. So he has spent an entire lifetime, an entire career cultivating, you know, his style, which seems to shift and change. But somehow the sum is greater than the total is greater than the sum of its parts.
And it doesn't feel affected like shtick, like Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, in the 80s, and he's doing, I mean, that worked in a certain, but even he's like, man, I've created a monster. Nick Cage is not doing shtick, for better or worse. So it's like,
because different every time.
He's never going to wake up and realize, oh my God, I've created a monster, because he's exactly where he wants to be in terms of his career, in terms of his acting approach. I got to say, if in Nick Cage, when he gets in his 60s and 70s, decides to sit down and write his book on nouveau shamanistic acting, which he's threatened to do in several interviews, I'm fucking buying that book. Yeah. I'm pre-ordering it on Amazon. It's going to arrive at my doorstop on day one.
Yeah.
Should we pivot into our favorite moments from the film fest? Or are you still wanting to dive into Cage?
No. We also have a prepared list of, like, Cage facts that we'll go into later. So if you're looking for more Cage talk, there's plenty of it to come.
This is still arguably Cage talk. It's meta Cage, maybe.
Okay.
So you want to take turns? I can go first.
What do you got?
His orgasmic acting from the shins down in Adaptation. And it's like, that tells the story. And it requires some thought and direction to do that performance. And it's a delight.
Only a shaman could possibly pull that performance off.
Anyway, that's one of my favorite moments that I didn't expect going into this film fest.
I'll come in with a film-related one, too. Basically everything about Vampire's Kiss. Vampire's Kiss, if you haven't seen it by now, is a phenomenal acting job by Nicolas Cage. You know, it's ridiculous. It's over the top. It's everything you think of Cage as, and it's him kind of in the prime, the peak of Nicolas Cage acting like a lunatic.
Yeah, and it's something you can appreciate as a very early Cage role. It's something you can kind of Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's something you can get drunk late at night and watch. It's the kind of the perfect bad Nick Cage film.
Yeah, no, easily the biggest laugh I had the entire time we were doing this was when he puts those teeth in and turns around and looks at the camera. It killed me. I don't know if you've seen the footage of the live watch, but it just destroyed me.
Yeah, no, it's the buildup, because you see, it's like, here's the photorealistic teeth, and they're going to ask, it's like, what can I get for $3? Well, I have these, and everyone knows, like, everyone has put those in your mouth.
Yeah.
And it's still somehow, when he turns around and reveals them, it's still, you should know exactly what you're going to get, but it's still funny.
And this is in a movie where already to this point in the movie, he has jumped up on a desk and shouted at a woman, chased her into the bathroom, he's been Nicolas Cage this entire movie.
He throws an index finger like a spear.
He does.
I mean, like,
and
like
yet
he's
somehow. This moment is still like that affecting.
Like, if he had a javelin in his hand and released at the apex of that, he'd set an Olympic world record.
Yeah,
it's
go right through her heart. I mean, the phone call afterward is just amazing. I was like, surely they're not going to have him actually talk on this phone with those teeth in, but they do.
Dr.
Glover, this is Peter Lowe. Peter Lowe.
And I even think that I think my favorite moment is when he courts his first victim of the teeth. Like that interchange where she just thinks he's some weird dude with a weird, weird pickup artist way to hit on women. And like, oh, yeah, fuck it. I'm game. The montage of him getting pelted with fast food in The Weatherman.
Yes.
And not just the montage, but just throughout the movie, how that's like all the different reactions, all the different emotional states, all the different. He goes through, he's like just resigned acceptance to white hot anger to deep bone hurting sorrow. It's amazing and it's funny and it moves the plot forward. It's one of my favorite moments.
And this is exactly the opposite for me because I had seen that movie before and I knew everything that was coming up, in regards to fast food, and yet it still worked.
Mm-hmm.
It hit me like a taco to the face.
Mm-hmm.
I have one that is not so Cage movie related.
Okay.
It kind of is. It's tangentially related. One of my favorite moments of the Season of the Cage was constructing the trailer for Season of the Cage. Because, you know, I used the Nick Cage losing his shit video as kind of a base for it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I went and looked at some of his other performances, like in Vampire's Kiss. There's the pillow biting scene,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which I included in that. And I just had a ton of fun going through Nick Cage's catalog of every movie I knew we were going to cover, and some of the movies in that other video, and just pulling out the weird clips and piecing them all together and making the, like, how do I put this with sound to make it funny? And then I did a whole, I don't know if people noticed, but I did a whole montage of him just saying, fuck. Mm-hmm. Over and over again, like shouting fuck you from Face Off. Mm-hmm. I strung every instance of him shouting the word fuck at somebody. It was a ton of fun to put together.
No, it's pure you. I mean, the sound production, the graphics, the video editing, like that's you're in your element, and you hit the ball out of the park on that. That trailer is really funny.
I did enjoy it.
This is something I shouted out at the very beginning, but I don't think few actors could portray Stanley Goodspeed in The Rock. And the epitome of this is his like stern warning of Sean Connery that, like, you know, this shit is not to be fucked with before he starts disassembling this chemical bomb. Every nerve fiber in his body is like quivering with the effort of like doing, but he portrays the academic, like, kind of rock star enough to be like, wow, this is a way to put together a machine full of death. And just like a second where, the scared, not field trained guy who is in the middle of this intense military situation. And he just has everything about the delivery, the body language, it shifts for just a second. And I don't think very many people can do that. And again, Stanley Goodspeed might be the definitive Cage role because in bad movies, it's easy to say, like, well, yeah, he makes a movie worth watching. But the things that he uniquely elevate, like, a lot of people could play the Weatherman.
Sure, yeah.
I think almost anyone could play his character in Con Air better.
Sure, right.
And adaptation is another one that's kind of uniquely Cage. But, man, that to deliver, it's a really elegant String of Pearls configuration is one of the highlights of the Cage Fest for me.
There is one coming up that we're going to talk about when I was compiling my list of Nicolas Cage facts for the end of this. I just found out so much about this Superman Lives movie that I honestly can't even believe that it was ever considered in the way that it was considered. And we'll talk about it, but that actually, like, 15 minutes ago here, just researching, it turned out to be one of my highlights of the whole series.
So I have seen some of this test footage from the Superman Lives project. Was that a Burton film?
It was supposed to be Tim Burton. Before Schumacher got a hold of it, Tim Burton
got a hold of Batman's nipples and twisted.
Yeah, did a couple Batman movies. He was slated to do this Superman movie, I guess, on the strength of his Batman stuff.
Sure.
But it was an ill-fated project from the beginning. I can't. That, like, let's talk about Nicolas Cage as a Superman fan, too, because he got wrapped up in this whole thing because he is a massive Superman fan.
It seems like a massive fan of comic books in general.
That, too, yeah. But specifically, I think Superman, I mean, he named his second kid Kal-El.
Yeah.
Which, if you're familiar with Superman lore, that's Superman's baby name.
Mm-hmm.
His
That would make him Jor-El, then.
I guess it would. Yeah, Marlon Brando, which
he should have gone to Brando.
Yeah,
there's a natural fit to play. He was born to play Superman's father. There's still time, because there in our lifetime there'll be another Superman film.
Yeah,
they ought to at least get Cage back. Puffy, middle-aged, aging Cage, and put him in the Brando role
for sure.
Yeah,
he says the Superman days are past at this point,
but his super dad
his super dad days, yeah, he could do it.
They're still ahead of you, Dick.
So he apparently bought Action Comics number one at some point, and he had it stolen from his house, and it was gone for 11 years, and it turned up in somebody's storage shed 11 years later, and they gave it back to him, and then that year later on, he turned around and sold it for like $2.1 million, which was the biggest single comic book sale at that point.
He like tripled his money on that, too, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when you hold on to something like that for 11 years,
right,
it's going to go up.
Yeah. Although I'm surprised that the condition didn't degrade in the storage shed, you know?
Yeah. Maybe. I'm sure he had it carded. Is that what
it was
called?
Frozen in carbonite.
Yeah. Yeah. It was encased in crystals.
Yeah.
It turns out the storage shed was in the
Fortress of Solitude. Yeah.
So, yeah, it was all preserved. Don't worry.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he got the comic book, but he was slated to be Superman. I mean, he had a contract with Warner, which said, hey, you're going to pay both me and Tim Burton regardless of whether this happens or not.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually made $20 million off of Superman, never made a Superman movie.
That says a lot about Warner Brothers' faith in a project. If like, you know what? You guys keep your $40 million. We're good.
But I have no idea why they had faith in this project. So the guy who produced those Tim Burton Batman movies saw the Death of Superman comics and was like, this is really exciting to me. I see a huge opportunity here. And he bought up the rights to the movie for it.
Yeah.
And then he had some very specific ideas about what he wanted to do with this. So one of them was he had three demands, essentially, when he took this to Warner and said, let's make this movie. First one was Superman can't fly. Superman has to use a jetpack to fly. Number two, he can't wear the iconic suit. And number three, he has to fight a spider in the end.
Oh, shit. I've heard, because Kevin Smith tells this story in the podcast for How Did This Get Made? The Wild Wild West,
which was produced by the same guy, because
he just had this, fuck, I got to have a giant spider, and it turned into Wild Wild West. And Kevin Smith was hired to write the first draft of the script. This is starting, because here's the funny thing is, I contemporaneously followed the story.
Okay,
I was telling you about this, because like this is like 95, 97. I was in high school, getting out of high school, but I was a huge comic book fan, and I was subscribed to like Wizard Magazine, and you'd hear this stuff, but it wasn't like, it was like dawn of internet, so it's like not like you could click on the magazine and see the test footage and see all this stuff.
My
so
God.
It's all like there was like a grainy shot of him in the proto costume with the terrible hairpiece that he wears.
Oh yeah, you got to see this footage. If it's
really a little
a thing
bit Con Air Nick Cage hairpiece.
It's a lot Con Air except darker,
and
so it's almost jet black.
Like if he put conditioner and brushed it out.
Right. And I've seen him in the costume during this test footage, both in and out of the hairpiece. So like I've seen him as Nicolas Cage in the Superman suit, which actually looks much better than Nicolas Cage in the hairpiece.
It's balding Superman though. Who
it is, but I think I'm okay with that. What I'm not okay with is this flowing mane of dark, jet, unnatural black hair. It's really like a frightening thing. And then the suit that they had him in at the beginning is just like this jelly suit, where like it's all like half translucent and very like awkwardly muscly.
Yeah.
To where it doesn't actually quite look like a human, which I think is kind of what they were going for. Like Tim Burton wanted to make this a story about alienation, and how Superman didn't feel comfortable on Earth at all because he was such an outsider.
My God, I can see him being almost like an Edward Scissorhands. People kind of, like, literally uncomfortable with his skin.
Apparently people who were in like ramping up for production on this were referring to him as Edward Supermans.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Why would Nick Cage, I guess this is nouveau shamanistic, but why would he be, if he's an unironic Superman fan, I usually associate that with someone that's like protective of the legend and the brand.
He seemed like he wasn't. Like he wanted, I think he
wants to make a stamp on it.
Yeah, I want to turn Superman upside down.
Oh no.
Which It sounds both glorious and awful at the same time, which is a lot of Nicolas Cage.
Well, and the other thing is, you can argue that Superman's less of a real character and more of an archetype, like that. So if he's one of the superheroes that you can kind of fuck with the most and do different takes on, and it's funny because I think that's what Zack Snyder was trying to do. He was trying to make like the sixth Superman film in a series where you explore his darker side, or what would it look like if Pa Kent was a little bit of an isolationist asshole, a little bit scared, more scared of a shadow than broadly generous. And you just can't, like, no one wants to see that in a Superman origin film. They want to see the Blue Boy Scout. And this would have been a train wreck of that proportion because, like, there's like heretical ideas. Like, why the hell with the jetpack?
There was some talk about an exoskeleton and him losing his powers and then regaining them and him dying and his spirit going into Lois Lane's baby. Like, it sounded fucking awful. There were three versions of this script, none of which were good, apparently. Kevin Smith, his rewrite, even the studio was like, nah, we're not going to do it.
Yeah.
But, man, I'm both sad that it never happened and also glad that it never happened. Because, I mean, what would Superman be? It'd be... I can't imagine it being any better than, like, Batman or Robin.
Oh, it's you know, no. It sounds like not. Yeah. Sounds like Batman was, like, the project to fit Tim Burton the best, because he's already kind of a dark, weirdo character anyway. Right. So, you know, Edward Batman Hands is like, yeah, that's kind of Bruce Wayne. He is kind of that weird, ill-fitting suit kind of guy that wears a mask. But Superman, not necessarily. Superman's the inverse of that, as famously pointed out in Kill Bill. We already stepped on a little bit because I want to talk about this nouveau shamanistic thing. And we already talked about that he had gone to film school for 6 months and he'd looked at to actors like Robert De Niro and Laurence Olivier as role models for his acting. But after he dropped out, he kind of like created his own method. It's nouveau shamanistic. And I want to keep that, like, so keep that in mind as I talk about my first real fact, which is an interview on why Cage decided to do Drive Angry. He says, initially what I was attracted to was the idea that I was going to get my eye shot out. The Season of the Witch, I wanted to get my eye shot out with a bow and arrow, and the producers didn't go for it. We never really got there. Even though they said they would, it never really happened. So when Patrick Lussier said to me, "You're going to get your eye shot out in a movie," I don't know why, but I just immediately said, "Yes, I'm in," because it was something I wanted to do. It's as simple as that.
This sounds like the way that I read he supposedly picks which meats to eat.
I don't know if you read about that.
It sounds dangerously close to that.
But isn't that like
oh, I want to get my eye shot out, so I picked a project where a guy gets his eye shot out.
That does sound like witchcraft. Like he's this physical transformation of plucking out your eye and doing something with it. Like that
putting
fueling,
it in a stew, right?
But that fuels his performance. Like there is something shamanistic about that. Like letting slicing your own hand and pouring blood in a pentagram, and it comes like this eye loss comes back because it happens in Outcast. Mm-hmm. He still got his eye torn out in Season of the Witch. They wouldn't let him shoot. Who says no? I'm wondering on that fucking set.
Yeah.
Who says no? You can't get your eye shot out by an arrow.
I think you get, man. It's hard not to kill a character who gets their eye shot by an arrow.
Yeah, especially in like the late. Also, right? who would be wielding the crossbow?
I mean, it would be.
You can't be blinded in the beginning of the movie.
Right. It would have to be Hagemar, but Hagemar dies kind of midway through.
Yeah.
And if Nicolas Cage gets shot through the head with a crossbow bolt,
right,
I'm going to say, well, that character's dead.
Right. Or like if it's at the climax, like either the demon or the zombie monks, but that doesn't make any sense either. So maybe it's just
Hagemar
like literally.
Would have to survive? Yeah.
Literally, Nick, do you see the set? Do you see a crossbow bolt anywhere? Do you see an arrow anywhere?
Right.
Like,
I'll bring mine
from
home. Don't worry.
Yeah. Like the demon can scratch it out. Is that good enough? But there. Uh-huh. There is something, and I'm going to return to this again and again, there is something very primal and primitive and warlock about that decision-making process, I think.
Yeah. Did you know that Nicolas Cage has his very own production studio?
I did not.
It's called Saturn Films. It has produced basically every movie that Nicolas Cage has worked on since, like, right after the Con Air Face-Off era.
Are you shitting me? For real?
Pretty much.
Not
yeah.
like the primary not, producer, not but one of the ones.
Yeah,
that
one
get,
of
okay,
the
yeah.
many producing companies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And he's also produced movies, I think, personally, that he hasn't actually, like, starred in.
Uh-huh.
So the first movie that his production company, Saturn Films, worked on was Shadow of the Vampire, which is that Nosferatu kind of comedy,
Willem Dafoe, right?
Comedy, how do you say, faux-umentary? What's the term for that? Mockumentary. Sort of thing. Yeah, which is actually really good. I enjoyed that a lot. But it makes a ton of sense when you look at just Nicolas Cage's oeuvre, right? Like, he is very much into those old kind of movies that his father showed him when he was growing up.
Yeah, I'm actually so shocked that he didn't think, because I was going to make the joke when you said, surprise, you know, some of these things he produces, they're not projects he himself stars in. I was going to make the joke as like, what role does Nick Cage look at and be like, oh, I'm not right for that.
Right.
But Count Orloff?
It seems like a natural fit.
He
yeah.
already did the thing in Shadow of the Vampire's Kiss. Yeah, I'm actually shocked to hear that he had to restrain the self-awareness, which, like, yeah. Or maybe it's like it's the shaman thing. Like, I've been a vampire, and there's nothing this role can teach me.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be that. I wouldn't put it past him.
Because, like, even when he does action roles, there's not... I can't say there's a Nick Cage role. Like, all of his heroic roles, they're very different.
They are. Yeah.
They're not like Arnold Schwarzenegger had a fucking role.
Right.
You know? Sylvester Stallone kind of has a lane that sometimes he gets in a little bit to the left or the right of, but he kind of go. Nick Cage is all over the fucking map. And just different genres, different tones, different... you know, looks and feels. Like, it does feel like he's always looking for something to stretch him or grow, which I think is admirable in a weirdo way.
It is, but at the same time, I feel like it's also slightly out of his reach constantly. Like, whenever he tries to do an accent, which that should have been my list of highlights, is just simply witnessing the number and quality of accents that Nicolas Cage does in his movies.
Mm-hmm.
We had no less than four. We had his Louisiana accent in Con Air. We had his Spanish accent in Con Air. We had his continental accent in Vampire's Kiss. And we also had some faux British thing in Season of the... I don't know what he's doing in that.
I think it's Imperial, Star Wars, Galactic,
yeah.
Basic.
Standard just, Galactic.
Yeah, we'll Standard Galactic.
But my point with the accents is to say he never quite nails that.
Right.
It always feels like he's reaching for something that he can't quite grip, but I do enjoy watching him go there.
Next fun fact for me, Nick Cage donated $1 million to Hurricane Katrina victims, and his extensive charity has landed him consistently on one of the top spots on Forbes list of most generous celebrities in Hollywood. And I was looking through, like is there something, like, in common themes? But it seems like he tends to donate to alleviate human suffering, like Hurricane Katrina. Like, and I think in his shaman, he doesn't have, like, a political goal. In fact, I think he says, like, he doesn't like to make political statements. He likes his politics to express in his performances.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is kind of also admirable that, you know, he doesn't have a pet cause, like, you know, animal welfare, or what. It's more of just like, there is some suffering, there are some people that need relief, and I'm gonna open up my checkbook and dig deep and give to that, this direct action. I think that's also admirable, and one of the things that also kind of turned me around of like, you can't be an asshole. Like, I think he cares about people. He cares about people in communities, and maybe that makes him do crazy things sometimes to identify or try to, like, that shaman thing, or try to make that spiritual connection. But it comes from a good place, it seems like.
We talked about how he's been, you know, 10 different people, as any of us are, over the course of his life. I wonder if there's any way to kind of track that with which charities he chooses to donate to. Like, I wonder if, you know, he's interested in a certain thing at a certain time.
Yeah.
And so he's donating to charities when there are no, like, crises on the table, right?
Right. Yeah.
Like Katrina, obviously. That
plus that's
that
an intersection.
Like,
I think we both have some facts
for
about
sure, yeah.
his connection with New Orleans, but
actually that's conspicuously missing from my list. Even though I read so much about it, and he's intricately, like, tied to Louisiana through his own personal tastes. I don't think he has any, like, actual heritage.
No, he's born in Long Beach.
Yeah, there's nothing about Nicolas Cage that would tie him to Louisiana, but he loves it. He loves New Orleans.
It's a shaman, I'm telling you. Weaving a tale here. I'm weaving a tale. If we ever got our hands like $100,000 free and clear, I would love to do a Nick Cage documentary. With the bones of that line being just shaman shit, because it goes pretty deep.
As long as we could get an interview with him.
I
would love to interview him.
He showed up voluntarily for a film fest about himself.
Don't step on my facts,
man. Sorry. So all right,
let's
hope.
Go to that one.
There's hope.
This is a perfect pivot. So he surprised the audience at Alamo Drafthouse's Cage Marathon with the 4, if you're trying to Google it, C4GD, where they just do a marathon of Cage movies, and they were doing 5 back-to-back. He just showed up last year and decided... He's been trying to go to it for a long time, but the schedule never lined up.
Yeah.
He's a very busy man. I don't know if you've looked at his filmography.
Yes.
But holy fuck, he's busy.
Yes.
He showed up last year, and he... immediately launches into a reading of Edgar Allan Poe's A Telltale Heart.
Which is awesome.
It's so Cage.
Yeah.
To just show up and, like, not like, thank the crowd and sit down or have a speech about his career or anything. Just go into a performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
I would love to see, because I remember when I was in 7th grade, we went to see a... it was the Indianapolis Repertory Theater, and they did like 4 different performances of, it was around Halloween time, of like macabre things. Mm-hmm. And it was like, the Monkey's Paw, like a reenactment, a stage play of that. But one of them was a guy who just did a dramatic reading of The Telltale Heart, and it was really affecting.
Huh.
And you know, with the, like, God, the lights, I just like Nick Cage going full Cage on that could be fucking amazing. I wonder if there's footage of that somewhere.
That's what I was thinking. That would be amazing. But then, you know, he sat down with the audience and he watched 5 of his own movies, just sat in on the whole marathon with him and did like an interview with questions and stuff. And that's just fucking cool. Like that's the kind of thing you hear about Bill Murray doing. And you're like, oh, that's awesome. He is an amazing guy. You know, he'll show up to your fucking bar mitzvah out of nowhere.
Right.
You know, Nicolas
Cage.
He won't
return an agent's phone call, but like that's something he will do.
Yeah, he'll do a movie once every 15 years if he feels like it.
Yeah,
but every other weekend he's at somebody's wedding.
It'd be fun. I was just thinking, like, what if we just don't invite him? We keep on doing Super Serious Film Fest, and he just finds us, finds us, and kills us.
Our address is on the website, so
that's true. That's true. He shows up at the UPS store. What the hell? Tell me where Aaron and Jim are. I'm trying to do Nick Cage accent, which is exercise in futility. Maybe a bad Nick Cage accent that I lose halfway through is the ultimate Nick Cage accent.
You might be right.
In a meta sense. Okay, I've got one. In the movie Birdie from 1984, he plays a ladies man who's severely wounded in Vietnam. During production, he decided to get his teeth pulled without anesthesia to, quote, connect with some kind of physical pain. Now, I did some digging because, like, I wanted to see, like, what the fuck? Like, because the way it was written in the article I first read it implied that he had all of his teeth pulled.
Yeah.
So apparently there's, and this happens to people from time to time, like, your baby teeth don't fall out, and they should have. They just kind of get displaced. So he had 2 baby teeth that needed to be pulled out anyway, and he had just never gotten around to doing it, and he had those pulled without anesthesia.
Oof.
So, but still, that's a fucking shaman move, man.
Yeah.
It's a fucking shaman move to, like, sacrifice part of your bodily integrity to work a spell. I'm telling you, there's something about this band. He's working some kind of dark Hollywood magic.
He's got Eye of Cage. He's got Tooth of Cage.
He's got Tooth of Cage.
He just needs, like, a paw and maybe a liver or something.
If you read an article where he had voluntarily had one of his testicles removed. For some kind of, like, you would believe it, right? Like, if I told you that, you wouldn't even question it. You'd just be like, oh my God, tell me more. It's something about this guy and this shaman shit. It's a real thing that I think he sincerely buys into.
I almost feel like we should have come up with a list of several fake Cage facts and thrown them in the mix just to see if people could tell. Because at this point, you're right. You could come up to me and tell me literally anything and say, oh, and all of that applies to Nicolas Cage. And I would believe you. Because I've read some weird shit on this guy. Along the lines of the shaman stuff, I discovered not only does Nicolas Cage have a production company, but he also has co-written a series of comic books with his son.
Yep.
called Voodoo Child.
Mm-hmm.
It's a series of six comic books.
Sounds pretty shaman-y to me.
Very shaman-y. This is so weird. I mean, he loves comics. Obviously, he loves that whole vibe of New Orleans and shaman stuff and witch doctors and voodoo. So I guess he took the next logical step,
mm-hmm,
and just decided to do a comic with his kid.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that with one of my facts, which is he has bought a large and ornate burial plot in New Orleans' famous St. Louis Cemetery. Now, if you know, mm-hmm, if you've seen any of these cemeteries, the unique thing about St. Louis cemeteries is they're all above ground. They're all these, yeah, like mini stone mausoleums, because you try burying people and you flood and the coffins shoot out of the ground, because it's all kind of below sea level. So he's got this like 9-foot pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some kind of Latin phrase inscribed in it that I thought I remember. It's like from Mini One or something. I don't know what it is. But he also bought... So this St. Louis Cemetery also houses a famous voodoo queen that I'm... Again, I thought I'd just remember that. Oh, no, it's Marie Laveau. That's right, because she was featured this season in American Horror Story. And he simultaneously bought this famous haunted house in the middle of the French Quarter of New Orleans, the Lollerie, I think is what the mansion is. And the story of that is like this woman housed and tortured slaves, like in a way that it shocked the sensibility of the Southern Louisianans so much that they were enraged and like tried to burn the place down. Just the sheer depravity of the way she was treating these slaves. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be haunted by the Lollerie's and these slaves. Again, he wants to be buried with a voodoo queen, and he wants to live in a mansion possessed by the spirits of multiple peoples. That's some shaman shit. And I think that, like, if you think of any kind of voodoo, because, you know, voodoo is part of that kind of, like, shaman tradition, and the hotbed in America is Louisiana and the South and New Orleans in particular. Mm-hmm. I really do think he's trying to tap into some kind of magic thing.
Yeah, I was actually reading the synopsis for his series of comics, and it very much sounds kind of like that sort of thing. So apparently it revolves around post-Katrina setting of New Orleans, mm-hmm, and it features voodoo mythology. The story is the son of a Unionist sympathizer is resurrected at his dying breath by the power of a voodoo priest in the 1800s. In 2005, New Orleans, Detective Robert Julian tries to solve the mystery of why several young girls have disappeared, which raises the question, how badly do we need Nicolas Cage in a new season of True Detective?
Oh, I thought how badly we need him to star in a film adaptation
or
of Voodoo
that,
Child?
Either one, but I feel like that would just be a new season of True Detective.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to...
God, I would pay money for that. Not enough money to get it produced, but as but much money as I could afford.
Back a Kickstarter on it, for sure.
Yeah, but it does kind of bring me to one of my next points, which is Cage being kind of influenced by this, you know, these older movies that his father showed him when he was growing up. There's the obvious, like, Nosferatu stuff with Vampire's Kiss, and... You know, you mentioned how he's got this pyramid and he bought this haunted mansion. Well, he also, during the filming of one of his movies, I can't remember which one, went up to essentially Dracula's castle. It's one that, you know,
oh, yeah,
there
one
are
in
many that claim to be,
yeah.
There are a lot of castles that claim to be Dracula's castle, but he went to one of those and he stayed the night there, and he came to the production the next day and they were asking him, like, you look like shit, man. What's going on? And he's like, oh, yeah, I was up at Dracula's castle and stay the night there. There's some spooky shit going on.
Yeah, you don't stay at Dracula's castle to sleep.
No, you don't.
You stay there to experience some shit.
Yeah. So he's practicing what he preaches, you know, and I got to give him credit for that. When he says, like, these are the things that influence me, he reflects that in his work. Like, apparently in Moonstruck, he had just these wild demands where he wanted to insert references to this John Cocteau guy who is a poet, mm-hmm, like an early 1900s poet, French poet, mm-hmm, and actually wrote like the original version of Beauty and the Beast, stuff like that, the French version of it. So like he has all these eclectic tastes both from the horror movies that his father showed him and also his own personal like readings and proclivities that he brings to all of his roles. And I think it makes him a more interesting actor.
It's a rich
most.
Cage tapestry that he weaves.
It really
sure.
is. Yeah.
It's no IKEA rug. You're getting the real thing.
Yeah.
Building on again my shaman theme, he got a large back tattoo of a lizard in a top hat and a cane to quote claim his own body. Explaining other cultures have initiations into manhood and that's what this tattoo was for me. This was a quote from the Philadelphia Inquirer in 1994, and in several of his roles you can actually see this tattoo. I think you can see it in The Vampire's Kiss.
No, really?
It's on his like left shoulder blade. Hmm. But and it is big. It's like 6 to 9 inches long. Like his the cage lizard itself. And in Vanity Fair 2013, he said that he in the movie Joe, that was also filmed in 2013, I haven't seen, that he was having a nervous breakdown and he requested to hold a venomous snake to calm his nerves.
And didn't he buy like an albino king cobra as well?
That sounds right. But the thing is, I tried like hell to see because how do you you got to follow up that question. You can't let him say, oh, yeah, I asked to hold a venomous snake because I was having a panic attack. And the just holding the venomous snake soothed me. Like, how? Why? The fact that it's sitting there not biting you gives you faith in it. Like it's got I mean, I'm sure I was like. We could have gotten some more Nick Cage. That's a rich. It's like seeing a mine of gold or silver and just turning your back on it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I feel like it's tied in with like the snake handling and the religion and the voodoo.
No. Uh-huh.
It's all like somehow in his mind has wrapped itself into this ball,
right?
That defines his actions.
Right, but it also reminds me of these like Aboriginal cultures in like South America that would carve these like big sculptures of. Lizards that can be like seen from space and stuff, and it does feel very tribal and primal, and again part of that shaman stuff that he's doing, claiming your own body like by virtue of birth. Most people say, yep, this is my body, I have the rights to it. But yeah, it's like, yeah, okay, sure, Nick.
All right, this next one is not so much like a Nicolas Cage fact as it is just something that I read in an interview with him that amused the crap out of me. And I wish it had actually come to fruition. Mm. It's another one of those like Superman kind of moments where, you know, it's something that he came so close to doing, but was just called off in the end. So you remember the movie, The Wicker Man, right?
Oh yeah.
According to Nicolas Cage, and this is in when he's speaking of Wicker Man in this interview, he says, originally, I wanted to play that cop with a handlebar mustache and a really stiff suit, and the producers wouldn't let me do it.
Why?
Can you imagine that already ridiculous movie where he's punching women out in bear costumes and screaming about bees in his eyes?
Yeah.
If he had a giant handlebar mustache and an extremely stiff suit?
No, I honestly...
What does that look like? I mean...
And why? That's the other thing. It's like, follow up. Like, what was the handlebar going to bring to the performance? Like, what was your reasoning? Like, people are... It's like they're like... They get this weird quote from like, ah, solid gold. Like, no, you've just...
Yeah.
You just found a few flakes in the stream. There's a pocket of gold nearby that's ready to be mined.
And my final fact, because we had to round it out with seven, is one that probably a lot of people already know, but he made a pretty large purchase of in more than one way, of a dinosaur skull, a T-Rex skull, which this is actually interesting from a couple of angles, because A, he bought this thing, and it turned out, oops, it was stolen. And so...
Dinosaur rustlers.
And so... The you know, people started coming after him about it, and they wanted to make this right. And actually, it turns out I think he wanted to make it right too. Mm-hmm. And he ended up just donating the thing back to the museum it was stolen from, which is pretty awesome of him. Mm-hmm. And took like a $600,000 or $1 million loss or something on the whole thing. The person he was bidding against to buy this thing is actually Leonardo DiCaprio. So a couple of like sort of eccentric actors were bidding on this thing. Nicolas Cage won. Probably he had that face off money, and I think Leo might have still been a little younger than Cage.
He's just still eating on that Gilbert grape, and
right,
not quite
Titanic yet. Like Titanic was about to break,
yeah.
But you know, how do you compete with Face Off and Con Air in the same year? Apparently, he made like $90 million in like 2009 or something.
Yeah,
or not 2009, in 1990.
I could see that.
1999.
Plus, like in 97, he got $20 million for doing nothing, for posing in shitty Superman costumes for a couple hours.
Yeah, incredibly high paid, so he spends his money on that.
Yeah, and he's like, even now, it's like, I don't think he's getting those paydays, but he's getting so many of them. Like, it's like, it's not unusual to see him come out 3 or 4 movies in a year.
No, not at all.
So here's the one we already kind of talked about. The interview, the UK's The Sun newspaper. I actually choose the way I eat according to the way animals have sex.
Yeah.
I think fish are very dignified with sex, and so are birds. But pigs, not so much. So I don't eat pig meat or things like that. I eat fish and fowl.
Why doesn't he eat humans?
Well, I don't think he thinks humans are dignified, because the thing about thing about fish is it's all external. Mm-hmm. Like the female puts the eggs out, and then the male comes and says, "All right, here." And then that's it. I mean, fowl kind of do. They definitely mount and they rut, I guess. But it's dignified in the sense that they lay an egg, and then you know the chicken comes out, and it's very, you know, it's not covered in blood. And I think he thinks that mammalian reproduction is disgusting. He has children, so he definitely engages in it, but I think he finds it unseemly. Now,
doing that kind of live birth sort of thing?
Yeah. Like
he's more of an egg kind of guy.
Yeah, he is. I think you're right. I think he's more of an egg. Like, coming out of this world, bluish green and covered in blood and screaming, versus coming out just fully formed and ready to go, having all the skills you need in life. I think that's something that appeals to him, and again, in a shaman kind of way.
This is something I could see literally any British person saying, and with a straight face. Oh, we don't eat them because they're not dignified. But Nicolas Cage doing it is awesome.
Yeah. I wonder... Can you imagine how weird a sex life is? Or maybe it's opposite. Maybe he just, like, that's part of his shamanistic energy. He just abandons himself to wildness. Because I'm almost like, I could see him having, like, a full-on hazmat suit that he has to, or the sperm is now in the receptacle. Please put your ovum in the airlock. Or it's like, I think he goes the other way with it.
Yeah,
he's
covered
in blood, and he's and dirt and grime, and he's chanting.
Because he's not going to eat anything afterward, right? There's nothing about this that he has to eat.
So
I think he can get as crazy as he wants. And I think Nicolas Cage probably views sex as one of his performances, if I had to guess. And he is willing to just experiment and see what works and see what doesn't.
He has...
See what his producers are willing to let him get away with.
He has to pull one of his remaining baby teeth every time he orgasms.
Yeah,
that's what triggers the fertilization period.
It's running dangerously low on baby teeth.
He is like maybe he's like a shark. It's just like, you know, he loses one baby tooth. That just like he's that's the shaman in him. You know.
Yeah.
You give an eye so you can get infinite baby teeth. And by my count, he's given at least 4 of his cinematic eyes. So
it's true.
He's probably got just infinity baby teeth now.
Season of the Cave.